So good afternoon, and welcome everyone to our study of the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. My name is Doug Thompson, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. I want to remind everyone that Jesus said, wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there also shall I be. And that's what we're doing today, gathering together in his name to read and study his dictation to Helen and Bill. And his presence with us will ensure that our understanding is deepened. We are gathered in his name. What we're doing here is both for our own learning and that of everyone. And I want to express my deep gratitude for the many contributions which have come from the audience over the months. This work is more accurate, and certainly my own understanding is better for that. For those who are here for the first time, I'm going to provide a bit of background. And those who are already familiar with this part can take a 5-minute break. As most of you know, the course exists in a number of versions as a result of extensive editing and abridgment over the years. While anyone looking at the earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that it certainly needed some editing, some of the editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally much more clear. One reason for studying this material is that it gives us a clearer picture, not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Helen and Bill, what he really meant. Some of us have found that clarity of understanding to be useful. The earliest written record of A Course in Miracles is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscripts. Her original shorthand notes, and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. Hardly a week passes that someone doesn't ask me about other versions of the Course which are also advertised or labeled as in some way original. There are actually 6 different versions of the text of the Course of which I'm aware, and 5 for which I've been able to obtain copies. Most of these have been published, and in most cases the publisher claims each is in some way original. This inevitably generates confusion. What we're working with today is original in the sense of being what was originally written down by Helen before the editing process began. What I've been doing for the past few months is going through the shorthand notes and identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext, and combining these two earliest and most original versions so that we end up with a complete text of what was originally dictated. So the resulting document is not any one of the 5 known scribal versions, but rather a combination of these 2 earliest ones. It includes essentially all of the original dictation for which we have any documentary evidence. This material has some rough spots. Some segments were written down only in point form. Some sentences were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need some editing in places, in that it's not a finished product. The notes also contain some material specifically labeled as a private point and not part of the course. This includes conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen and Bill at the time. While not part of the course proper, these outtakes, if you will, provide considerable insight into Helen's experience and often involve explanations of miracle principles, practical examples from Helen's own life, and as such expand our understanding of both the course proper and Helen's scribing experience, which resulted in what we know of today as A Course in Miracles. So that's what we'll be doing today. Some reading, some commentary, discussion. Last week we got as far as T31B37L. And I should give you the URL. For those on the radio, go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com and click on the original dictation. No. Go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74. And then click on original dictation. And I'm going to post a link here on the board for those who are with us here. I'm going to try anyway. There we go. And if you want to follow along, that link should take you to the text that we're going to be reading from. And I think if you just do Control F and search for 37L, you'll go right to where we're going to be starting today. Text Chapter 1, Section B, Paragraph 37L, T1B 37L. Okay. On that note, about hands. If you want to say something, contribute, comment, ask a question, feel free to raise your hand. Deborah will be monitoring the hands and sort of being the chairman here, because usually I'm looking at other screens and not the board and won't even see your hand. So on that note, I'm going to hand the mic over to Deborah for her introductions.
Hi, everyone. Sound check. Got some yay yeses here. Yes. Hi, Carmen. I see you've made it in here too, Cam. I have to connect with you later. All right. So I guess what I'd just like to start with is us coming together, just coming together into our own alignment inside, which will all come together at one point. As soon as we get in there, as soon as we feel any sense of alignment, we're together, and that will strengthen our connection. And any distractions, just gently ask them to await your focus later, but you'll definitely return to your distractions. All distractions, know that about us. We're really fantastically committed to our distractions. So we are come together in alignment with Holy Spirit's guidance and Jesus' teaching to help us awaken and help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today, going by Jesus' direction of what miracles we perform when. And Lord, heal me. So this is just really brief. Amen. Any questions of what Doug has said before I carry on with the reading, which will be starting at, where are we? T1B37K. And I'll post it. Okay. I'm watching for heavy material in here as per usual. But there's a couple things. It really wound me out. Note also that you close the book and put it aside without consulting me. Ask, is that all? Answer, no. Add the following. These notes are serving, among other things, to replace the handwriting on the wall which you once saw next to your own altar, which read, "You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting." That's so lovely. Here you go, Doug.
Well, there, right off the bat, we have one example of Helen writing her own words in here. Jesus is telling her that she closed the book and put it aside without consulting him. And she writes, "Ask, is that all?" So that's her question. She's asking, okay, got it. I'll ask, is that all? And he says, no, add the following. That the notes are serving, among other things, to replace the handwriting on the wall, which you once saw next to your own altar, which read, "You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting." Now, there's nothing else in the written material that I've seen that gives us any explanation of that particular experience or vision or revelation that Helen had, other than what we read right there. But there's a clear suggestion in what's being said here that the idea that she got previously, that she'd been weighed in the balance and found wanting, is being replaced by this new dictation in which she is apparently not being found wanting because she's doing a pretty good job of getting this down. Okay, Deborah.
Scribes must learn Christ's control to replace their former habits, which did produce scarcity rather than abundance. From errors of this kind, the sense of deprivation is inevitable, but very easily corrected. The following is in relation to question about sex. Tell Bill, the One More River is related to sex. You might even explain it to him as a tidal wave, a term which he will understand. You won't. Both of you are involved with unconscious distortions, parentheses, above the miracle level, close parentheses, which are producing a dense cover over miracle impulses, which makes it hard for them to reach consciousness. Sex and miracles are both ways of relating. The nature of any interpersonal relationship is limited or defined by what you want it to do, which is why you want it in the first place. Relating is a way of achieving an outcome. Doug.
Okay, couple of things here. Back to 37M, scribes must learn Christ's control to replace their former habits, which did produce scarcity rather than abundance. Now that is one heck of a sentence with five layers of meaning. The notion of Christ's control is a theme which will recur throughout the course. And it's summarized here. And in many places in the first chapters, we find something akin to a table of contents where points are listed, a very brief description is made, and then that point will come up again and again and again with expanded explanations in a variety of different contexts, such that by the time we get to the end of the book, we will have found a given concept, such as Christ's control, very thoroughly described, discussed, and explained. But initially, it just gets labeled. However, the second phrase, to replace their former habits, is very indicative of what Christ's control means. And it basically has to do with the statement elsewhere in chapter 3, that where Jesus says, I will substitute for your egos, if you wish, but never for your soul. And the habits here, I believe, are referring to ego habits, patterns of thought, habits of thought, which are producing scarcity rather than abundance, which implies they're illusions, they're not true thoughts, or they're bad habits. And Christ's control can replace or substitute for our bad habits, good habits in their place. And that is a key theme throughout the course, this whole idea of the substitution, the seeking of guidance or there's a distinction made between guidance and control. Guidance where we need to take responsibility, control for the trivial. And then the One More River, a theme which comes up again and again. Bill initially mistyped that as One More Rivet, and that Freudian slip, which was described as a Freudian slip by Jesus, is discussed a number of times, and it's something personal here between Jesus and Bill, and I don't know what it is, but it's related to sex, and Helen is told that she might even explain it to him as a tidal wave, a term which he will understand, but she won't. And this is one of several instances where Helen takes dictation. She has no idea what it means. And she's told, tell Bill, he'll understand. In other words, she's taking stuff down for Bill. And Bill gets it and sometimes explains it to her. I see Carmen has written that she thought that was a reference, and that would be the handwriting on the wall, a reference to the lifetime when Jesus says she misused her scribal abilities for private gain instead of public good. That's possible, Carmen. I don't know that that is or isn't. Could be. I don't know. And now we move into, we're getting into the instructions about sex again and unconscious distortions, which are producing a dense cover over miracle impulses, which make it hard for them to reach consciousness. Sex and miracles. And here's a really critical one. The nature of any interpersonal relationship is limited to or defined by what you want it to do, which is why you want it in the first place. Relating is a way of achieving an outcome. Now, that's really interesting in terms of the whole outcome idea, which suggests to me that he's talking about how Helen, he's talking about Helen's and Bill's unconscious distortions rather than prescribing an ideal. So that the distortion is that they're relating as a way of achieving an outcome rather than relating openly and candidly in love. And therefore, the relationship is limited by what they've decided they want it to do, and why they wanted it in the first place. And I think that's where you left off, Deborah. I'm not sure. I kind of got lost there. Did you read paragraph P?
No, I was just starting with paragraph P. Were you still wanting the mic, or you were passing it over right now, Doug? Can I be heard? Oh, okay, okay, over to you. Okay, Steve, or, and I'm not sure what the other name that goes with the Steve. I think it's a D word, D name, but anyways, here's the mic.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, you touched on it briefly, Doug, but I'm trying to figure out what, because I've always had a question in my mind about, and I don't know where it is in the urtext, and I have another question for you about the urtext, because the, I was talking to a friend, Cam, the other day, and we were trying to find that part in the urtext that relates to, what the heck was it, about the correction of error. I don't know where the correction of error is in the urtext, so that's part of the question I want to ask you about. In the correction of error, it says something about, or is that where it says it? No, investment in reality. Forget about that for now. In this thing, I only know it on page 28, where it says fear and conflict, and I'm recording now from the third edition or second edition or third revision or second edition. It's not yours, but where it says fear and conflict, you just touched on this right here about control. So I'm just going to read it here because you touched on it, and I don't know, and I'm going to ask a question. It says fear and conflict. Being afraid seems to be involuntary, something beyond your own control. Yet I have already said that only constructive action should be involuntary. My control, that's what you touched on there, can take over everything that does not matter, which we would think would be things in the dream. And is that relating to like when Jesus actually told her where to find the dress or the coat that she needed instead of letting her basically as a scribe be distracted for hours and hours on end looking for a coat or a dress that she exactly needed? Is that one of the examples of where it says my control can take over everything that does not matter while my guidance can direct everything that does matter if you so choose? You just touched on that briefly, but I'm asking you to kind of explain that in maybe a little bit more detail with maybe more examples if you could, because the only thing that comes to mind for me is that story about how Jesus told her what store to go to, what rack to look at for the coat or the dress that she needed. Is that where he says, my control can take over everything that does not matter, while my guidance can direct everything that does if you so choose? So that's kind of where I was asking for more clarification there, if possible. And I'll go and find this other thing that I was looking for a little bit later, the part about the, you know, where he says, I once asked you to give up everything, and then he goes on to say about But if a brother asks you to do something, do it because it doesn't matter. I think it's an investment in reality in this third edition, and I'm wondering where I might find something like that in the Urtext, because I think you're about the most familiar person with the Urtext that I know of right now. That's kind of why I'm asking that question. Cam wanted to look it up in the Urtext, and I said, I don't know where that is in the Urtext. So those are kind of the two questions, if you have time for those, and I see your hand up, Doug. So thanks for letting me share and ask the question. Here's the mic back.
Okay, there's a variety of things there. On the website, www.miraclesinactionpress.com, there is a concordance to the Urtext. You can enter any word and find all instances of that word with five words of context on either side, which makes it pretty easy to find quotes, though it usually takes more than a minute. Especially until you get used to it, and I don't have more than a minute now to go look it up. At the beginning of Chapter 2, however, there is a quote that's relevant. Fear cannot be Christ-controlled, but it can be self-controlled. Fear is always associated with what does not matter, and it prevents me from controlling it. The correction is therefore a matter of your will, because its presence shows you that you have raised, its presence there being fear's presence, shows you that you have raised the unimportant to a higher level than it warrants. You have thus brought it under your will where it does not belong. This means you feel responsible for it. The level confusion here is perfectly obvious, the levels being that which matters and that which does not matter. That line about Christ control belongs to those things that do not matter, and I can't find it real quick here in the Urtext either. That line occurs in both versions. And I'm pretty sure that the higher shopping service is precisely what is an example of precisely what Jesus is talking about. That the use of our will isn't appropriately invested in things like finding the store that will sell me the winter coat I want. And that example is really, really, really superb, because in it Jesus points out that he knows the coat that Helen wants and will end up buying anyway. He can just save her a lot of time by telling her where it is. It's not that he's telling her what kind of coat to buy, or even whether or not to buy a coat. It's she needs to buy a coat. She's decided to buy a coat. She sets out to do so. She could spend a lot of time finding just the coat that she wants. But as in this higher shopping service, and this is what I believe means by Christ control, Jesus just tells her exactly where to go. And when she gets there, the salesman who sells her the coat, which is exactly the coat she wanted, has a child with some psychiatric needs, and Helen is one of the few people in the world that can refer him to somebody who can help. So the salesman is helped, the salesman's child is helped, Helen is helped. Everything works effortlessly. And I think this is also an example of you need do nothing except listen. That Jesus will take care of these kinds of things for us. And last week I ended without telling a story about the Celestial Shopping Service that happened to me recently, and I'll just take this opportunity to share that story. I was going to start off with it, but I forgot. But I'm reminded, for actually over a year, I have had car problems of a vexatious sort that I have been trying to solve myself. And to make a very long story about car problems short, a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, I guess, I set out in the morning to take my old van to a mechanic to have many hundreds of dollars worth of work done that it needed to pass an emissions test, which is required in the province of Ontario, and which there's four different things on that test at different times. The van passed every one of them, but it would never pass all four on the same day. It was incredibly vexatious. And exactly why it wouldn't pass with vehicle emissions, it can often be very difficult to tell when they're really close to the line, and some days they do pass and other days they don't, just what you have to fix in order to make it get through the test. So I had been putting this off and delaying and just felt a real resistance to putting any more money into this old van, which otherwise ran fine. You know, you drive it down the road, everything worked. It just, its emissions were a little out of kilter. And as I was getting dressed to go out and take the car to the mechanic, something, I don't know what it was. I sat down at the computer and I logged in to the website of the local Chrysler dealer and hit on the key to look at his inventory of used cars. And I wasn't thinking about buying a car. I guess the idea had crossed my mind, but I certainly had formed no intention to do it. The intention I'd formed was to keep the old one as long as it would keep going. And but there I was checking out these used cars, and one of them, a late model, very low mileage Dodge Caliber, just struck my fancy. I looked at that and I said, wow, it was cheaper than I expected it to be. And, well, there was one on the lot that had precisely the rather rare set of features I prefer in a car. That is, it doesn't have air conditioning. It doesn't have power windows. It doesn't have power locks. It has a manual transmission. All things I would choose if I were ordering a new car. But things that are very rare these days, dealers don't put those cars on their lot very often. So here was a car that had these attributes. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. And I didn't think a lot more. I put my coat on, went out, and as I was walking to the van, the words went through my mind from chapter one. If you will tell me what to do, I will do only that. And I got in the van, and I headed out to the mechanic. And I was about halfway there when I thought, gee, this vehicle is going to be in the shop for several days. If I want to actually look at that used Caliber up on the other end of town, I better go check it out now while I have a vehicle, because it's liable to be gone in a few days. So I turned around and detoured to the Chrysler dealer. And on the way, I saw in a parking lot my friend Jimmy, who drives a Dodge Caliber. I saw him sitting there in his car at a coffee shop. So I pulled in beside him and asked Jimmy how he liked that particular car. And he had nothing but high praise for it. And he drives commercially. He's put 260,000 kilometers on that car in 2 years. And he basically had nothing but high praise for it. And I thought, my goodness, this is like a sign or something, eh? So I continued on to the dealer, and I said, what happened was, to my mind, quite remarkable. Last year, when Chrysler was having its near bankruptcy experience, it provided its executives in Windsor, Ontario, where the Chrysler plant is, or one of the big Chrysler plants is, with cheap cars rather than super duper loaded down luxury models. They were all given Dodge Calibers with manual transmission, no power windows, no power locks, just, you know, basic car. And in January, these cars are turned over and they're distributed amongst the dealer network to be sold as used cars. And one of them was sitting there, and the sales manager was kind of antsy to get rid of it. It had been there for 6 weeks. He couldn't sell it. I bought it sort of on the spot. And after calculating the trade-in value, I checked the black book values. They sold it to me wholesale. They did, in fact, want to get rid of it. And it's practically new. It's got 5,000 kilometers on the clock. That in miles would be a little under 3,000 miles is all that's on it. It is practically new, and it is exactly the car I would have bought anyway. So I didn't have to take the van to the mechanic. I left it there as a trade-in and drove home in a new car. Problem solved in the space of 2 hours. A problem that had been vexing me before I asked Jesus' help for literally years. I've been fighting with the emissions problem on that van and ended up with a car that I am totally pleased with at a price that I'm totally pleased with and that I could afford. So I was thinking about Helen and her coat as this was all going on and thinking, this is like too wild. This really happens? This is really happening? Now, the kicker was that the sales lady who sold me the car says she was trying to work the sale out on her computer. Her computer was malfunctioning, and she was expressing frustration with her difficulties at finding anybody competent to fix the computer. She tried several people and was very unsatisfied, but it had a problem. And I told her about my computer mechanic, who's been keeping my antique computers running pretty darn well for 5 years, who is actually very close to the dealership, and I happened to have one of his cards in my pocket. And she thanked me profusely for this recommendation of a computer mechanic. And again, I thought of Helen's experience with the coat and the salesman and how the salesman needed her, and this salesman maybe needed me, and there we have it. I call that the Celestial Shopping Service. And I'm going to drop the mic here.
Hey, Carmen, go ahead.
Thank you so much for giving me some time to put a 2 cents in here. Our group has been experimenting with a hire shopping service for a long time and just get delightful results from it. And the key feature is always to point out that it saves us time. The course talks about the fact that we create our lives to be stressful and busy, and it's a defense mechanism of the ego to keep us from doing the work on ourselves and to connect with other people, which is what miracles are all about. And so many instances of the hire shopping service have freed us up, helped us to relax into our lives and really find the time to make those meaningful connections with other people. But I wanted to stress, the reason why I put my hand up is we have used it for everything from finding a chartreuse pair of leggings in the middle of winter for an engagement outfit to a house. So, you know, all of the stresses that are normally involved in, you know, just finding the perfect house. I told Jesus that I needed a larger space for our group to meet because our house wasn't big enough. And within 2 weeks, he just, I won't go into all the details, just house sitting for a friend, finding a newspaper. We didn't get the newspapers on Sundays, and there was this house that looked perfect, went to the house. 4 other couples were interested in it, but the owner knew me, and he and his wife decided that of the people that wanted the house, Tom and I were going to have it. And I mean, it was just the perfect, perfect location for us, everything. So it can save an enormous amount of time if we stop, you know, and think about it, that all of the stress that we put into mundane affairs, like, you know, the shopping and the car and the house and all those things, they don't have to be distractions. We can be led easily, simply, joyfully, quickly to exactly what we need, and it will, like you say, just flow. Thank you for the time.
Steve, go ahead.
Yeah. I guess you're reminding me, too, of two or three things that happened to me, and then I'll just share a brief story about what happened to Barbara Huff and Robert Varley. But I had my car that had about 3 or 4 years ago, I had my car that had a leak in the gas tank, and I hadn't been finding time to repair it. I've been lazy, and I went to my last sweat lodge. I got kicked out of the sweat lodges after this, but on my way to my last sweat lodge at this woman's house, they had the sweat lodges in a sauna. But on the last time I went there, and I couldn't figure out exactly when I was going there, but the last time I went there, I drove past a place I'd never gone before. I went in an unusual way I'd never went before, and I found this car that I'm driving right now. It's a 1993 Ford Escort station wagon, gray, and they had a price of $275 on it. And when I bought the rear view mirror, came back to Kansas from Wisconsin, I got a warning ticket saying my windshield wipers hadn't worked and I hadn't been fixing them. I thought I was going to just, thought it either had to be the switch and it wasn't the fuse and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I took my car in for an oil change, which I don't usually do. I always wanted to do that myself, and got the oil change for $19.95. And then I asked them, they said they had a mechanic that worked on electronics, but he wasn't available that day. I took it back, and here I'm thinking I can't even get the part from a parts store. I'm going to have to go to a dealership and get it. And this guy happened to fix it. He just found something wrong with the fuse block, that there was a loose wire in the fuse block, and even though the fuse was good. So he fixed it for like $35 or $40, something like that, a lot less time than it took me to probably do the whole diagnosis. So that worked out really, really excellent. The other story I was going to share briefly on that same line is that when Barbara Huft and Robert Varley in The Peace of God Is My One Goal, that book, were looking for the new Dove, they called it a Dove Mobile at the end. They were driving a 1960 Plymouth Valiant for I don't know how many years on their trip with a little plastic Jesus, and there's a whole story about that, sitting on the dashboard of their car. I don't remember the whole song, but nothing can help hurt me as long as I got my plastic Jesus bouncing on the front, I know, the dashboard of my car. But anyway, every van that they looked at, they decided they were going to get a van. Every van that they looked at, it seemed like there was a holy encounter, just like you had said. And many times in her book, she talked about wanting a place to sleep and not wanting to pay for a hotel and getting a free room and stuff like that. And then she had this encounter with a guy that fixed her car. She had bald tires and she didn't know it. And she, the guy wouldn't talk to her in town because he embarrassed everybody in that little town talk. So he got her a room 20 miles out of town, and she ended up with a free hotel room and a bath and everything she wanted. All she had to do was talk to her counselor's guy for an hour or two when he left. And it's just sometimes we don't recognize the form it comes. But with that Dove Mobile, they had to
get back on. All right. Looks like that computer is back happy. Okay. T1B37P. Deborah, you're back. Can you see us? Can you hear us? Here's the mic. Okay, I guess she's not really back. So I will read T1B37P. Indiscriminate sexual impulses resemble indiscriminate miracle impulses in that both result in body image misperceptions. Interesting. Both result in body image misperceptions. The first is an expression of an indiscriminate attempt to reach communion through the body. This involves not only the improper self-identification, but also disrespect for the individuality of others, essentially treating people as sex symbols, I think is what we're talking about here, treating people as bodies rather than souls. Self-control is not the whole answer to this problem, though I am by no means discouraging its use. It must be understood, however, that the underlying mechanism must be uprooted, a word you both should understand well enough by now, not to regard it as frightening. So the underlying mechanism or cause of the indiscriminate sexual or miracle impulses or body image misperceptions, the underlying mechanism is an idea, an illusion, a false idea that must be uprooted and replaced with the correct idea. Then in Q, okay, you're back. You were booted from Pal Talk. Yeah, that happened to my other computer, but not this one. I don't know if my hand's working here. And if it's not, I'm going to just type when I want to say something. or you're going to pause at the end of a paragraph and ask me. Okay, here's the mic.
Oops, where did you say, where you were reading, Doug? That sounded like you were reading in 37Q, but I'm not sure. Because do you actually want me to do 37P and 37Q again? Starting now at 37Q. Okay, cool. Yeah, there was a message that came up from a Pell Talk message that said that we were... That Pell Talk was corrupted and wanted me to download something, but it never sent anything up. Anyways, that's what's going on right now. Carmen is asking the question, what is the underlying mechanism that must be uprooted? Doug, do you want to take this? Here you go.
Oh, my hand seems to be working again. The underlying mechanism is... that's a good question. I was actually wondering that myself. In the first sentence, we read that indiscriminate sexual impulses resemble indiscriminate miracle impulses and that both result in body image misperceptions. What is the cause, though? And the underlying mechanism here is referring to the cause, not the result of the misperceptions. The result needs to be addressed with self-control, though self-control is not the whole answer. But the underlying mechanism would be, we can say this with confidence about the underlying mechanism, that it's the cause that leads to indiscriminate sexual impulses and indiscriminate miracle impulses. And it's a thought, it's an illusion, it's a distortion. And the previous paragraph may give us the answer. Unconscious distortions, which are producing a dense cover over miracle impulses, which makes it hard for them to reach consciousness, and that could lead to indiscriminate impulses reaching consciousness, and the cause or problem there was the willful attempt to use relationships as a way of achieving a specific outcome. And that's very closely related to the miracle principle on indiscriminate miracle impulses or indiscriminate miracles, miracles performed as spectacle or miracles performed because we think somebody needs healing without asking Jesus' guidance. So in both those cases, it would be the focus on the outcome that is our mistake. We're worried about the result of our action and how can I achieve a certain outcome, as opposed to worrying about being loving and following guidance and leaving the outcomes up to Jesus, knowing that he understands what miracles I need to perform to achieve the best outcome for everyone. And there's no way I know enough about everything in order to be able to determine what I might do that could achieve the best outcome. And later on in the course, we're repeatedly told not to worry about outcomes. That if we behave appropriately, if we think appropriately, we will behave appropriately. And if we follow guidance, the outcome will be fine. The outcome will be optimal. And the higher shopping service is an example of that. The outcomes are taken care of when we simply do what we're told. And that relates to the, if you will tell me what to do, I will do only that. And if we're willing to listen, we will be told what to do. So the underlying mechanism would in that case be related to the desire to control outcomes rather than leaving outcomes up to Jesus, I would guess. And I'm going to drop the mic there.
Carmen, did you want to explore this on the mic any further? Cam, I'll pass it to you.
Yeah, I don't know how it's going to come out in words. I wasn't able to type it. I guess how I'm hearing this is focusing on the result. Or the outcome is like not knowing why that is wanted and like keeps the distortion in place. So if I like use the miracle or their sexual impulse or whatever, I forgot how the wording is exactly that you said. It like would, how do you say that? What it would do to the distortion and not addressing, the actual, like what the miracle is there for. So it will keep being a misused miracle impulse. Is it misused or whatever? It would be a misused miracle impulse because what is wanted by getting these results or getting these outcomes, the question that comes before the result or, you know, that's the driving force, isn't recognized or seen. And so it's still like in the driver's seat. Okay. I guess that's it.
Yeah, that's useful. Thank you for that. And what occurs to me as you were speaking is that motive and outcome are both closely linked in terms of this underlying mechanism in paragraphs 37O and 37P. Because the problem being defined in 37O is the limitations. Well, I'll read that sentence again. The nature of any interpersonal relationship is limited or defined by what you want it to do, which is why you want it in the first place. And this is the distortion, that you're looking at a relationship or a person in terms of what you want him to do. I look at you. What do I want you to do? What kind of outcome do I want to come from our interaction? If I'm an employer conducting interviews, I'm looking to see an outcome of a good employee. Instrumental use of people, rather than understanding that a relationship is holy, its function is the exchange of love, and its outcome is in the hands of Jesus. When two people are relating in love, then what comes out, if that's their motive, to simply be loving, then what comes out will be a good outcome for all concerned. And Carmen writes, what can I get, not what can I give? Yeah, the unconscious distortion being described there is what can I get? Looking at people, looking at relationships in terms of what can I get? What do I want that person to do for me? And why do I want to relate to him at all? Can he make me richer? Can he make me happier? Can he make me more popular? As opposed to who is there in God's eyes and what possibilities for interaction and sharing with this person will be made available if I open myself to this person. And I think that the unconscious or the underlying mechanism is associated both with outcome and motive in that sense, with the motive being something other than love, essentially an instrumental view of a human being as a commodity who may or may not deliver something I want to me, and the idea of relating as a way of achieving an outcome. In other words, being manipulative towards the other person in order to persuade or convince him to do what I want, whether it's give me money or give me love or give me praise or give me a job, you know, whatever it might happen to be. And that is the underlying mechanism that needs uprooting, as Carmen just typed. Yeah, that is definitely what I sense being identified here. And it's a very, very significant thing because we are all, I'll use that word with some hesitation, there may be some exceptions, but certainly most of us are socialized to use people in what, as I term it, instrumentally, as instruments to achieve our goals, our desired outcomes. And that's in part because a lot of people treat us as instruments to achieve their goals. So we're used to being treated that way in the workplace and often even in family situations and school situations. So we learn as little wee tiny kids, that's the way you treat people. We sort of come by it naturally or inevitably in a social context where that is a dominant way of interaction. But its problem, or the problems associated with it and the limitations, are being spelled out here. And Jesus is saying, I want to uproot that belief system that people are instruments and show you another way of relating to others that will be much more gratifying and joyful than what you're accustomed to. And I think that's what we're being told there. Yeah, it is huge, Carmen. Getting my tongue tied here. Carmen writes, that's huge, Doug. Thank you. And I think it is. I think it is huge. And it is, the same theme comes up again and again and again later on in the course, where there is a repeated emphasis on the holy relationship as the means to salvation. That salvation is not achieved alone. However much communication and revelation occur between man and God, it is worked out in relationships with others through such things as forgiveness and behaving in a loving way that allow the Holy Spirit, God the Holy Spirit, to infuse our life experience with heavenliness, you might say. This is what brings reality or the real world into our day-to-day experience in space and time. The relationship where love is authentically, genuinely shared. Through that connection, wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, again, to stress that point, through that connection, it's like closing a switch or touching the wires. The current of God's love flows between those two people, and the miracle is the result, because all miracles come from love, right? Miracles are a product of love. Love occurs in relationship. Love does not occur sitting in, a hermit cell. Now, certainly that hermit may feel love, but until he's interacting with others, the current isn't flowing. The love is not being communicated and shared. It's not moving. And it's in that motion of love from one to another and back again that the Spirit of God manifests in space and time in human life experience. And the manifestation is frequently miraculous and always joyful. Okay. So this will leave us at the beginning of T1B37Q, Deborah. Okay. I'm on a roll here today. Here's the mic.
Hey, a good roll, too. Thanks, Doug and y'all. That was very enlightening. So we are picking up at T1B37Q. All shadow roots have to be uprooted because they are not deep enough to sustain you. The illusion that shadow... I'm starting this again because I think I'm saying shadow. All shallow roots have to be uprooted because they are not deep enough to sustain you. The illusion that shallow roots can be deepened and thus made to hold is one of the corollaries on which the reversal of the golden rule referred to twice before is balanced. As these false underpinnings are rooted, in parentheses, or given up, are uprooted, wow, as these false underpinnings are uprooted, in parentheses, or given up, equilibrium is experienced as unstable. But the fact is that nothing is less stable than an orientation which is upside down. Anything that holds it this way is hardly conducive to greater stability. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, that might be perfectly clear the way Jesus stated it. I'm just going to stress a couple of points. Shallow roots, and this would be the mistaken ideas about using people as instruments, they have to be uprooted because they're not deep enough to sustain you. They can't be deepened. It's an illusion to think that these shallow roots can be deepened and thus made to hold. And this gets back to the golden rule reversal. The golden rule basically is summarized in Matthew 7:12. Whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. So, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Referred to twice before, and I should actually footnote the previous references. So all these false underpinnings, or the belief that people are instruments for my use to achieve my outcomes, they have to be uprooted or given up. As these false underpinnings are uprooted or given up, equilibrium is experienced as unstable. And we've touched on this a few weeks ago, where there was a reference to through the initial undoing of a bogus thought system, one can experience vertigo, one can experience disequilibrium, one can feel off balance because nothing is the way you thought it was. Yet, what's really being established is equilibrium where there was disequilibrium. And the confusion is that the ship that's been tossed by these terribly high waves and is pitching and rolling is suddenly floating peacefully on a mirror smooth sea. And that seems totally confusing because it's unfamiliar. But the fact is that nothing is less stable than an orientation which is upside down, or the idea that people should be used instrumentally. And anything that holds it this way is hardly conducive to greater stability. In other words, this uprooting will achieve equilibrium, and you're not going to achieve it without it, because the shallow roots, the unstable system you've been trying to make work, can't work. Which brings us to T1B37R. And I'm going to look at the board here as Deborah picks.
Yeah, it's used very directly in with this example here, but to me it is very genetic about the shift and that equilibrium being it is experienced and gone unstable because the thing it's aligned to is false. So it's whipped away, nothing to hold on to until the realignment comes. Makes me think of in a spinning exercise. I don't know how many people, other people here I'm sure have experienced it, where someone spins really quickly and someone else is the guide, and before they start to spin, you connect eye to eye, and then as the person is spinning, the facilitator keeps their hands perched in a way that is sort of directed and guiding that person. They feel that energetic guide, and then their eyes are still ready to receive the eyes of the person when they stop spinning. So when they stop spinning, they could go into that real dizziness, that nauseousness, that headachey, whatever is happening there for them. But if they connect eye to eye, that alignment happens, has a chance to happen. They can align to the energy of the other person, and they don't go into all those uprooting sensations. That's a sort of example that comes to mind for that. I'm going to carry on reading with T1B37R. The whole danger of defenses lies in their propensity to hold misperceptions rigidly in place. This is why rigidity is regarded as stability by those who are off the mark. Note, the only final solution, parentheses, no, Helen, this has nothing to do with the Nazi use of the term, close parentheses, you just got frightened again. One of the more horrible examples of inverted or upside down thinking, parentheses, and history is full of horrible examples of this, close parentheses, is the fact that the Nazis spelled their appalling error with capital letters. I shed many tears over this, but it is by no means the only time I said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Doug.
Okay. It should be noted, first of all, I'm going to comment on R. The whole danger of defenses lies in their propensity to hold misperceptions rigidly in place. This is why rigidity is regarded as stability by those who are off the mark. So ego defenses, defensiveness in general, whenever we feel the need to defend ourselves, I think all categories of defenses have this propensity to hold misperceptions rigidly in place. What we're actually defending is a misperception of the situation. It was, in fact, the misperception which caused us to feel attack and the need to defend, but the more we defend, the more we reinforce the cause of what led us to feel attacked in the first place, which is the real danger of defenses and defensiveness. And then into the final solution. Now, Helen Schuckman was born Helen Black, and her father was of Jewish background. She married Louis Schuckman, who was also Jewish, and she lived through the Second World War, although she was not involved in it. She remained in the United States. And so the Nazis' use of the final solution, quote-unquote, on the Jewish population of Europe would have been something probably quite personally meaningful to her. And the words, the only final solution, when Jesus used them, frightened Helen. And so Jesus is saying, no, Helen, this has nothing to do with the Nazis' use of the term. And then he says something really interesting after essentially commiserating with Helen's feelings that it was a horrible historical example. He says, I shed many tears over this, but it is by no means the only time I said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So while pointing out that something quite horrible happened, and in fact noting that many horrible things happened, history is full of horrible examples, the conclusion is not to condemn those who carried out the horrors, but rather to approach them with the attitude of forgiveness that he showed at Calvary with the people who hung him on the cross. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Recognizing that they didn't know what they were doing. And if they had known, really known, what they were doing, they wouldn't have done it. They were operating under delusions. And the delusion they were operating under was often defensiveness. The Nazis responsible for the Jewish Holocaust came to believe that the Jews were a threat to them. And they felt that they were simply acting in self-defense, many of them. And those who executed Jesus also felt threatened by him and that they were acting in self-defense. The self-defense defense of atrocity is common and appears logical to the ego, but when it's operating, we don't know what we're doing because the self is not defended by killing others. The illusion there is that it is, but in reality, it's not. Okay. Jesus says he's still affected by the pain we cause ourselves, Carmen writes. And the reason I'm reading what you're writing, Carmen, is because it's standing out there in chartreuse pink, and it's hard to miss. I'm going to give you back the mic, Deborah.
I think that's a really interesting statement, Carmen, of he's still affected by the pain we cause ourselves. we're going to be affected too. I mean, if Jesus is, then we are still going to be affected by the pain our brother causes themselves as well. I can't see it any other way. If Jesus is, why wouldn't we be? I'm here, Doug.
Okay, I'm just going to answer Lee's, I believe it's Lee's comment about the table of contents on the left-hand side of the document on the net. What's in the table of contents are subheadings. They're the subheadings found in the Hugh Casey version and the subheadings found in the Foundation for Inner Peace version. Those subheadings are inserted at the appropriate places to help one line up the versions. Plus, I inserted a few new ones where there's significant topic breaks in the material. The Ur text and the shorthand notes, as they exist in manuscript form, have no chapter breaks and no subheadings. So these breaks, chapter breaks and section breaks, are inserted to make the material a little more manageable. But if I included every paragraph number in the table of contents, the table of contents would have several thousand entries and would end up being pretty much useless. So when we're not at a section heading, the best you can do with the table of contents is go to the paragraph reference that's closest. That'll get you generally within a page or two of where you want to be. Or just use your Control F in your browser, which is the search function in just about every browser. I don't know any that it's not. And then type in a unique search string, such as, for instance, 37Q, because there's no other paragraph 37Q in any other section, and that'll get you right to the particular paragraph. Or type in the entire search string, T space, 1 space, B space, 37Q. And again, the browser will take you right to that paragraph. So that's what the contents, and I know there's got to be a better way to do it, but that's the best I've come up with yet. Okay, Deborah.
Carmen, take the mic.
Thank you so much for giving me a few minutes here. I think it's important to just note that Jesus is saying that he cries about what we do to each other, because there is a school of thought in the Course community that basically says that we should ignore everything around us that's causing pain. And Jesus isn't advocating that stance here at all. And it's one of the great blessings to me from the, you know, finding the Ur text that this statement came to light. There's kind of a little allusion to it. I think it's in the manual where he talks about you see problems that you think are not your own, but they are. We're in this boat together. And if there is pain in the mind of humanity in general, it's something that still, you know, needs to be healed before we can go home. If Jesus is saying he's still at the level where he sees atrocity and he feels for us. He feels for himself, because we're not going to go home until all the minds are healed back into oneness. And so this total offhands, don't see, you know, the three monkeys, I hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil kind of approach to the Course, I don't think is being validated. And I'm really sad that this particular emphasis is used. A friend of mine in Cincinnati was going to a teacher up there, and he was told that rescuing an almost dead kitten was the equivalent of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And he called me in great distress because of his teacher telling him that. And he wanted to be reassured that the Course isn't about us becoming totally immune to what's going on in the world around us and doing something to be helpful. And it's not a pretty tendency in the Course. And I just wanted to emphasize that Jesus does not say that he is detached from us and our suffering, even at his level of development. And I don't think it's appropriate for us to foster that belief as something that the Course is advocating. And thank you so much for the time.
Carmen, I completely agree with you. And I thank you for stressing that. This is highly congruent with the shortest verse in the Bible, which is in the Gospel of Matthew, I believe, Jesus wept. And he wept having been told that his friend Lazarus had died. And the idea that love means being insensitive to the suffering of others or the sadness of others or the plight of others, even where it can be reasonably said they're the authors of their own misfortune, it is, to my mind, quite inhuman to think of the child who ran too fast and therefore fell down and skinned his knees should be ignored rather than comforted. Okay, he made a mistake. Okay, he caused his own problem. But he's still a brother in need of help. And if we disable our capacity for compassion for a brother or a child or a kitten, then we have lost part of the humanity God endowed us with. We have lost something of our soul, the ability to communicate, to empathize, to receive with compassion what others are transmitting to us. And I would also like to underline what you said about problems elsewhere in the world. Should we ignore them? Or not, or how to deal with them. And the idea that, yeah, we're all in this together. And whenever one of us makes an advance, the entire human race takes a step forward, we're told. Not in those words, but that idea. Similarly, whenever one is suffering, whenever one is lost, we all, in a sense, take a step backward or are held back because the ultimate conclusion of this experience in space and time is that we all go home. And until everybody gets there, as it were, nobody's going anywhere. I mean, you know, we're all in this together. And it is the privilege of the forgiven to forgive, and it is the privilege of those who are a little further along on the path to help their brothers who are a little further back on the path. That is what the holy relationship is. From those who temporarily have more to those who temporarily have less, such that we all get further along more quickly. All together or not at all. Yeah, that would be the theme. And certainly Jesus is showing us and telling us in a myriad of ways and on practically every page of this book that he's busily helping, not for himself in the sense that he already has it figured out. He's helping because he loves us and he knows we need the help. So he's quite prepared and willing and able to provide that. The elder brother is the model he uses. How does an elder brother deal with his younger brother if the younger brother is making a mistake or doesn't understand something? He doesn't ignore him. He helps him. He's there for him. He looks after him. And the model that Jesus also uses is that of father and son. How does a loving father deal with a son who's having difficulty? He helps him. You know, he doesn't ignore him. All right. I'm going to drop the mic here, Deborah.
Lynn here. I didn't even take that into consideration. Here you go. Here's the mic. Did you just leave? Oh, no. Don't tell me that the system got her, too. No, there's your name. Here, Lynn, here's the mic.
Okay, can you hear me? Yeah, Pal Talk is acting really crazy. yeah, I think a lot of teachers and a lot of course students get confused about the difference between not jumping in and suffering with the person who's suffering and using the strength, your strength, and your strength combined with the Holy Spirit to pull them out of that suffering. It's like, you know, you see your brother, you know, fall into the river and go into the whirlpool, and you jump in there with him to try to save him, instead of going to the Holy Spirit, going to the strength, and getting that, you know, the rope, getting the tool that you need to be able to pull your brother out of there. And it's really kind of an arrogant thought, is that I can save you of my own ability. When the reality of it is, you know, we have to go to the Holy Spirit to give us the strength to do these things. And it is not in any way at all kind to tell a person that their suffering is their own fault. That is, in fact, not very nice at all, because people who are suffering are not in a position where they can think about those things. Maybe later on we can talk about it, but not when they're, you know, in the midst of the whirlpool. You know, we really, it is our job when people are in the midst of the whirlpool to help them in the best way possible. And so, yeah, being kind and you know, allowing the Holy Spirit to speak for God for me. You know, that is what I ask for every day. And thanks very much for the opportunity. Love you guys.
Yeah, well spoken. I completely agree. And that really relates to the miracle principle on indiscriminate miracles, jumping in to the river to save somebody who's fallen in. That would be the instinct of many people. And, you know, somebody's in trouble, we want to help. And there's numerous examples in the Ur text, Edgar Cayce being one, of people who were so bent on helping others, they wore themselves out and were not always very helpful at all. But only Jesus knows what miracle is going to be able to be received and is going to really be beneficial in any given time. So the thing to do when the guy falls in the river is to ask Jesus, what do you want me to do about it? And it may be to go get help. It may be to call the fire department. It may be, if I'm a good swimmer and a certified lifeguard, to jump in and pull him out. There's no pat answer the answer wouldn't be the same for everyone in the same situation. Somebody is going to, what am I trying to say here? that the appropriate behavior will not be the same for everybody, and Jesus will know exactly who needs to do what, and if we turn to him, the problem gets solved. If we do it on our own strength, then we put ourselves at jeopardy and quite possibly put the person we're trying to help at further risk by behaving with that indiscriminate miracle that isn't really going to be helpful for one reason or another. So the point again is, in terms of what we do, you know, listen, learn, do. And having listened and having learned, we know that the first thing we do is ask Jesus. And when we do that, we will know what else we need to do. And that can, in some cases, might actually be nothing. But for some of us. But the appropriate thing to do, the genuinely miraculous and helpful thing to do, will be made clear in that process of giving the problem to him and not making the outcomes our own responsibility. And I also agree that when somebody falls down and skins their knee, telling them it's their own fault is not the most helpful thing you can do for that person in that moment. Ultimately, they need to learn that, and ultimately they will. But again, when you tell them is something, ask Jesus. You don't necessarily need to tell them. He might be doing that on his own. Okay. I'm going to drop the mic here.
A link in that seems to me to be that if a student refers to as the body outside of themselves, that person outside of themselves doesn't exist, so they give it no more thought. They withdraw from that, sort of annihilate that person in their mind from themselves. And to be on the receiving end of that, I noticed that it's not only missing an opportunity for us to join, for them to join with me, I'm looked at as their projection only, and even in body form. And then it solidifies an illusion in their own mind, and there's a block, a bigger block that actually happens. You are just an illusion is a common A Course in Miracles curse. Yeah, and it just feels really weird being on the receiving end of that, and really the block can become more solid. And, you know, if they are annihilating that person on the outside of them, how do they ever expect to do the miracle principle that says that, you know, you are instructed who to help, when to help? And so it just doesn't make sense to have that comprehension. So I see that as key in here in being a link that connects this whole idea. Okay, that's all I wanted to say on that. So I'm going to, well, I have never heard anyone talk in this manner. It must be happening in Gather. You're so cute, Lee. I'm going to continue reading here at T1B37T, right? I'm on 37T, I think so. I'll scroll up because I did have it right on here. Yep. Okay. Wow, wonderful conversation. This is exciting. Here we go. All actions which stem from reverse thinking are literally the behavioral expressions of those who know not what they do. Actually, Jean Dixon was right in her emphasis on feet on the ground and fingertips in the heaven, though she was a bit too literal for your kind of understanding. Many people knew exactly what she meant, so her statement was the right miracle for them. Example of the right miracle. For you, Bill, it would be better to consider the concept in terms of reliability and validity. A rigid orientation can be extremely reliable, even if it is upside down. A rigid orientation can be extremely reliable, even if it is upside down. In fact, the more consistently upside down it is, the more reliable it is, because consistency always held up better mathematically than test, retest comparisons, which were always on shaky ground. You can check this against Jack's notes if you wish, but I assure you it's true. Split half reliability is statistically a much stronger approach. The reason for this is that correlation, which is the technique applied to test-retest comparisons, measures only the extent of association and does not consider the direction at all. Here you go, Doug.
I just want to point out that Jesus is giving Bill an example from statistical theory that some research scientists would find extremely relevant and comprehensible, but anybody who's not familiar with that level of statistical analysis will find it largely gobbledygook. I think the key point in there is that which is consistently wrong can result in very reliable, predictable results. So a rigid orientation can be extremely reliable, even if it is upside down. The cup that's upside down will reliably dump the coffee in your lap, for instance. But reliability, and this goes back to the reliability validity issue we dealt with last month, reliability does not imply validity. Just because the cup always dumps the coffee when you turn it upside down does not mean that the valid way to keep the coffee in the cup is to turn it upside down. Okay, that's what that's about. Yeah, reliability does not imply validity, but in the world of research scientists where they're trying to design tests that will have valid results, they start off with looking for tests that at least have reliable results, because a reliable result, at least then we know we're measuring something. But the scientists of the day tended to lose sight of the validity issue and ended up with reliable tests that measured something, but they didn't know what they were measuring. And they got themselves really quite confused on that. Deborah.
Thanks, Doug. I just saw Sir Smoke a Lot come in and left. Okay, here we go on at T1B37, V as in Victor. But two halves of the same thing must go in the same direction if there is to be accuracy of measurement. This simple statement is really the principle on which split half reliability, a means of estimating internal consistency, rests. Note, however, that both approaches leave out a very important dimension. Internal consistency criteria disregard time, because the focus is on one-time measurements. Test, retest comparisons are based on time intervals, but they disregard direction. It is possible, of course, to use both by establishing internal consistency and stability over time. You will remember that Jack once told his class that the most sophisticated statistician are concentrating more and more on reliability rather than validity. The rationale for this, as he said, was that a reliable instrument does measure something. He also said, however, that validity is still the ultimate goal, which reliability can only serve. I submit, parentheses, I'm using Jack's language in this section because it always had a special meaning for you. So did Jack. Close parentheses. Your confusion of sex and statistics is an interesting example of this whole issue. Note that night you spent in the scent of roses doing a complex factorial analysis of covariance. It's a funny story to others because they see a different kind of level of confusion than the one you yourself were making. You might recall that you wanted that design and Jack opposed it. One of the real reasons why that evening was so exhilarating was because it represented a battle of intellects, parentheses, both good ones, by the way, close parentheses, each communicating exceptionally clearly, but on opposite sides. The sexual aspects were naturally touched off in both of you because of the sex and aggression confusion. Doug.
Okay, again, Jesus is using examples that would be very relevant to Helen and Bill. Jack is one of their colleagues and an esteemed researcher in the field of psychology. And Helen was doing some work with him on statistics, which Bill was supervising. And that is the context of the specific examples with regards to experimental methodology, statisticians, reliability, validity. And I think it's important to remember that statement about the only valid use of sex is procreation is within the context of this validity reliability discussion. And that word validity had a very specific and scientific meaning to Helen and Bill. And cannot be equated to the only right or permissible use. Valid use has a very, very, very specific connotation here. And again, for those not versed in the science of statistics, a lot of these examples will go right over our heads. And so I'm not going to say much more beyond pointing out that this is an example from Bill's and Helen's own life experience that would have been particularly meaningful and instructive to them and other scientists who understand that particular language. But for those of us who don't, it's problematic. And yeah, I just got kicked off here again. But I'm back. Okay, Deborah, here you go.
I listened to the tape of this section before the session, Doug, and I wanted to bring to light something that Teddy had brought up that's on the tape, and it was neat where he said, where Jesus says in here about the good intellect, the battle of the intellects, both good ones, by the way. So validating the intellect as serviceable to us, so because that's another tendency that people can do is invalidate our intellects, but it's validated here. That's what I had picked up as Teddy's point anyways. Here you go.
Yes, thank you for reminding us of Teddy's contribution on that before. And there's several themes in here which are closely related in the same vein. The body and the intellect are often despised, shall we say, along with the ego, it's worth mentioning. But, and reliability. Yet, back to 37X, he also said, however, that validity is still the ultimate goal, which reliability can only serve. Doesn't mean reliability is bad. It means reliability is the servant of validity. When the servant runs off without his master, the servant is problematic. When the intellect, which is there to serve the soul, runs off without its master, the intellect is a problem. When the body, whose function is communication, forgets its master and what it's for, and runs off without control, it too is problematic. That doesn't mean that reliability, bodies, and intellect are bad. It means they are servants of a higher purpose, and as servants can be extraordinarily useful. But outside of their proper function, it's a bit like when the wheel comes off the car. The wheel can become a terribly dangerous thing when it runs down the street without any control. Yet that doesn't mean wheels are bad or are to be despised or are themselves problematic in their proper place, in their proper context, serving their proper function. They're quite useful to us. And so with intellect. And I think that that's important to remember, that all of the attributes that God has endowed us with, physical, mental, intellectual, whatever, have a proper function in his perfect plan. When used for their proper function and within the proper Christ guidance and control, are useful tools, like the hammer in the carpenter's toolbox. It's very useful. But it can also, when used improperly, be very destructive. But the tool is not the problem. It's the context, the purposes for which the tool is used. Okay. Here you go.
Wow. And we're time is ticking on here. Wow, I can't believe how late it is. T1B37Z, parentheses, it is especially interesting that after the battle ended on a note of compromise, with your agreeing with Jack, he wrote in the margin of your notes, virtue is triumphant. Parentheses, Helen Schuckman note, resubmission, dominance, feminine, masculine roles entered into this. Close parentheses. While this, in parentheses, remark, was funny to both of you at the time, you might consider its truer side. The virtue lay in the complete respect each of you offered to the other's intellect. Your mutual sexual attraction was also shared. The error lay in the word triumphant. This had the battle connotation because neither of you was respecting all of the other. There is a great deal more to a person than intellect and genitals. The omission was the soul. Close parentheses. Big omission. Here you go, Doug.
Well, here we're actually kind of closing the circuit on what we were talking about earlier in terms of the underlying mechanism and the tendency to regard people as instruments to achieve particular outcomes. There is a great deal more to a person than intellect and genitals. The omission was the soul. And elsewhere in the course, there is considerable stress on this problem of the perception of people as bodies, but not even entire bodies, looking at certain parts of the body as significant and ignoring the rest, and in this case, omitting the soul. And therefore, the aspect of the person which is capable of that holy relationship, which alone can bring a truly joyous relationship. So again, it's the problem, and this is actually one definition of idolatry, the pattern of taking one part of a whole and elevating it above all the rest and worshiping that part to the neglect of all the rest. It ends up with an imbalanced or a distorted perspective. It doesn't mean that the thing that's being worshipped is bad. It means that the inequality, the distortion in perception is problematic. And whether, again, you know, whether you take intellects or bodies or anything and elevate them into a dominant or masterful role, you get into a problem because they're servants. They're not masters. It's not the thing itself, be it intellect or genitals, that is problematic. It's the distorted perception in which the soul, the whole person, is ignored and only a portion of the person is focused upon. All right. Here is the microphone, Deborah.
Okay, so I'm carrying on at T1B37AA. First of all, Doug, I'm just going to note the time. There's 9 minutes to go. I don't know if there was something that you wanted to pull together at the end here or keep on reading a little bit. No hand, so I'm going to keep on reading. I submit, in parentheses, after a long interruption, that is a mind, parentheses, soul, that if a mind, in parentheses, soul, is in valid relationship with God, it can't be upside down. Jack and the other very eminent methodologists have abandoned validity in favor of reliability because they have lost sight of the end and are concentrating on the means. Doug.
Well, in some sense, what I just said is a summary of what we've been reading today, and this paragraph is also something of a summary of the point that Jesus is making to Helen and Bill in this segment that we've been reading today. The distinction between means and ends. And again, I'll point out the use of the word validity. The abandonment of validity in favor of reliability, and the whole discussion that's been had many times by many people about the meaning of validity in that statement, the only valid use of sex is procreation. And the emphasis here, again, is on balance and proper perspective and seeing the whole and responding to the whole, which can only be done if a mind is in valid relationship with God. Otherwise, we're going to be in relationship with illusions, and we're going to have a distorted partial perception. It doesn't mean that what we see isn't there, but it means that our perception will be distorted. We'll be seeing some things and missing others, and therefore we'll be playing with less than a full deck, if you will, which results in a distortion, which results in an illusion, which results in an error. And the means and ends is going to be discussed in much, much, much greater detail in pages to come. But it's the end or the outcome that is in divine hands. And to have lost sight of the end is to have lost sight of God, ultimately. And to end up focusing on the tools rather than the task for which the tools are but servants. And the next paragraph, we have time for that one, and it's cute. Here you go.
Did you just touch on about mind soul there, Doug, about mind with soul in parentheses? I missed it if you did. Have anything to say about that? No? Want the mic? I'm wondering if it's mind and soul, mind, parentheses, soul. I mean, it almost looks like it means mind means soul. Here you go. Maybe the soul part of the mind. Here's the mic.
It would be good, actually, to check the notes here, which would take me several minutes to dig out that page and see what was actually originally written down. The words mind and soul are sometimes almost used interchangeably. There is a certain non-scientific imprecision in the use of terminology in a lot of what Jesus is dictating to Helen. And the same idea is sometimes encapsulated by a variety of different words, and specific words sometimes are used in a variety of different contexts, and in a different context mean a different thing. I'm not sure whether she first wrote down mind and then thought to add in soul, or whether she's thinking this is a correction. But the mind, soul, I think in the context here, both words are actually quite quite appropriate. And that may have been added as an element of clarification. I don't know on that one more than those observations. But I think we still have time for the next paragraph about the artist and the pencil sharpener.
What you're saying there, Lee, makes sense to me. Lee was pointing out to you, Doug, to remember what she wrote when you go back to check. And listen, we are all joined in mind here in the world. It is the same in heaven. Souls share the mind of God. It is not an error. Read it from a different angle. And that actually quite makes sense. So, okay, so I'm going to carry on reading.
You've got to pick up the mic to carry on reading. You dropped it, and I don't think you noticed.
No, I didn't notice, but in retrospect, I did, because I think I clicked right on it to drop it. So T1B37AB. Remember the story about the artist who kept devoting himself to inventing better and better ways of sharpening pencils. He never created anything, but he had the sharpest pencils in town. Parentheses. The language here is intentional. Sex is often utilized on behalf of very similar errors. Hostility, triumph, vengeance, self-debasement, and all sorts of expressions of lack of love are often very clearly seen in the accompanying fantasies. But it is a profound error to imagine that, because these fantasies are so frequent, in parentheses, or occur so reliably that this implies validity. Remember that while validity implies reliability, the relationship is not reversible. You can be wholly reliable and entirely wrong. Doug.
Okay. I think that paragraph says it so well. I don't need to add a lot, and we are getting towards the end here, so I'm going to say my goodbyes and express my appreciation to all of you who have contributed today, and I'll apologize on behalf of PalTalk for the technical problems many of us have been experiencing. And it's great being with you guys Sundays afternoons. I learned so much from what you have to contribute in going through this material, which I find perennially rich and rewarding and illuminating and simply joyous to deal with. And I love sharing the joy with you. Here's the mic, Deborah, for your goodbyes.
Thanks for all the contributions, the fantastic discussions, guys. This was very nice. And thank you to all radio participants for listening and tuning in and listening in. I'm looking forward to the next time. It will be continued next Sunday, 4 to 6. Thanks again, everybody.
And just a final comment, because I keep forgetting to mention this. Most of our sessions have been recorded successfully. And so if you've missed a part, you want to catch or review, it can be found at www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74. And go look for Listen and Archive, and that will lead you to the audio archive. And thanks again. Good night. God bless. And I guess, Carmen, you're up next. Here you go.
Hi there, sweethearts. I just want to say that I join with everybody who was saying that this 2 hours just go by so fast. I want another hour.